I've been contemplating this pair of practices we might call inward facing awareness and outward facing awareness. A lot of the classic Zen teachings we hear emphasize this inward-facing awareness, like just directly see your true nature and become Buddha. Inward-facing awareness, the one awareness facing back on itself and recognizing itself as the source, as the unborn, undying, clear, ungraspable source of everything. Stillness free from suffering. The inward-facing awareness. In Zazen, we can open to this, but it's only half the story. And there's also the outward-facing awareness, which is how this empty source manifests or expresses itself as all our experiences of body, feelings, emotions, thoughts, perceptions. You might say that those sound like inner-facing, but actually from the point of view of the awareness as the source, those are experiences manifested by awareness, we might say. And moving even more outward, then we have the whole world and others and so on. Outward facing awareness. So to me this seems a little bit different than just being aware of things. Mindfulness of our activities, that's also a practice, but the outward facing awareness is requires first actually recognizing the inward facing awareness and then seeing how all the outer experiences are expressions of that. And the interfacing awareness is often the main thing, as I mentioned, you know, expressed in Zen teachings. And it's easy to get sidetracked in other practices. Like, for some reason I was recalling this story of my early years living at Tassajara in the mountain monastery. And I'd heard these teachings about the interfacing awareness, but in a way they don't say much. They just say, like, see your nature and become Buddha. And so it's much easier to work on outer kind of practices. So I was I could see that I was getting caught up craving and attachment and so on, and how there's so much suffering in that. So I was working on these kind of outer practices. And I remember, I was really getting into trying to train this person, but I wasn't really in touch, maybe at all, or very little with this inner facing awareness. So it's already kind of hard enough, actually, like Tassajara practice period in the winter in the mountains, sitting all day in the silence and cold and nothing exciting is happening. And but still I felt like I have to tame this wild creature called me. So I took up this practice of, amongst other practices, of not eating after noon. It's one of the Buddha's practices he offers to the monks. So already there's just not very much in for the evening meal anyway at Tassajara, but you kind of have to show up for the Oryoki meals every day. So I would go, and I was kind of hoping that people wouldn't notice if I just sort of passed on the food offering. Then I wasn't trying to be more austere than the other monks. I was trying to study my own desires. And I had looking back, I think it was a wholehearted spirit of a young man trying to dive wholeheartedly into the Zen practice. But it wasn't like making me more peaceful or happy, actually. It was, in fact, I was just getting more and more hungry. There wasn't much food anyway. And so in a way, I was trying to be easygoing about this practice, but I think inside, actually, I was maybe suffering more, right? One of our chants says, outwardly still while inwardly moving. This kind of looks good on the outside, but actually, inside, I was making this great effort. Maybe a little bit like the Buddha in his early years would make this great effort with no success. This was much less effort than the Buddha. But it wasn't really leading to anything except struggle, actually. Yeah. And at some point after doing this for a while, you know, we're having the meals in the Zendo, this formal meal style, and we had the same seats every day, right? So this woman who was sitting next to me, who was also, you know, getting into her stuff like we all do in a long practice period like this. One time, after the meal, she came up to me and just like kind of laid into me, like really, really like, started yelling, upset, and like, why do you not take the food in the evening? Come on, it's being served to us. What do you think? You're better than the rest of us. This was kind of her feeling. And I was like, no, I'm just trying to, like, practice. I was hoping nobody would even notice. I was just trying to train my own desires. And she didn't like my answer. And I think then, as I recall, maybe it was something like, as I was walking away from the conversation, I just like burst into tears. I just broke. And I think it was because I was like making this huge effort, and it was not appreciated. In fact, it was scorned. So one of the practice leaders, I think, kind of like took me in, and I remember just like sobbing kind of uncontrollably, which was unusual for me. I think something kind of cracked there. So the memory stands with me. Yeah. And I think this is an example of trying to wholeheartedly practice, but in this way that's like not actually that helpful. It looked good maybe to me, on the outside. It didn't even maybe look so good to somebody else. It annoyed them. But I'm completely missing the point of the inwardly facing awareness, which this inner awareness could care less whether I eat dinner or not, actually. It's just lovingly appreciating whatever's happening. So I think we maybe have to go through some of these things in practice like this, right? We we have to make a wholehearted effort. We want to make a wholehearted effort, and yet it's very easy to kind of miss the actual point of the wholehearted effort, which we might say is this inwardly facing awareness, and then bringing it out and letting the inner awareness interact with the world as the outward facing awareness. So the outward facing awareness, we have Zen sayings like the ancient teacher Yun Men said, everyone has a light, but when you look at it, you can't see it. It's mysterious and obscure. So actually, that's the inward facing awareness. Right? That's an instruction, I would say, or an expression about the inward facing awareness. Everyone has a light, but when you look back at it, you can't see it. It's mysterious and obscure. And then he went on to say, what is everyone's light? The kitchen pantry and the main gate. So I hear that as an expression of the outward facing awareness. What is this light? When you look back at it, you can't see it. It's mysterious and obscure. What is it? It's the kitchen pantry and the main gate. It's the zendo and the patio. It's everything we experience is the light. And those things we can actually aren't so obscure or mysterious. Those things we see. But there actually are light. The outward facing light. So we need to attend to both the inward facing and the outward facing awareness. I've been looking at Charlotte Joko Beck's wonderful book, Everyday Zen. This is a real classic. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend. She tells this story that a student of hers told to her about a man who's caught in a flood, maybe a tsunami or a huge rainstorm, but a serious flood. Like the water's coming up around his house, so he climbs up onto one layer of the roof of the house, but the water's keeps rising and rising, and some boats are out in a rescue mission, and a boat comes by and says, "We're here, hop on in," and he says, no, God will save me." Like, oh, well, if you say so, we have more people to rescue. So they keep going down the flood, and the water's rising, getting more and more turbulent, and he has to climb up to another layer of the roof as the water rises even higher, and meanwhile, another rescue boat comes by and says, "We're here, we made it to help you, hop on in the boat." And he says, no, God will save me. And then, of course, the water just keeps rising. And now he's, like, on the roof, but he's actually, like, half covered in the water, holding on to the TV antenna or something. And a rescue helicopter comes from above and lowers down a rope and says, "Grab on, we can save you now." He says, no, God will save me. And the helicopter gets blown away in the wind. And meanwhile, the water gets higher and higher and actually rises up above his head, and he drowns. And he goes to heaven. And when he gets to heaven, he asks God, "Why didn't you try to save me?" And God says, "I did. I sent you two boats and a helicopter." So maybe this has something to do with if we get too involved in the inward-facing awareness, we might also call God as some sort of separate reality, then we miss the expression of God, which is trying to help us all the time, the outward manifestations of awareness. If we think it's just about the inner light, then we're missing half the story. I like to emphasize the inner facing a lot because I think it often, in this way, doesn't get emphasized so much. Even in Zen communities, we emphasize mindfulness and stillness, but recognizing and attending to this light seems so important in order to then attend to the outward facing light. Sometimes in Zen, we also talk about these two as the inward facing light is like the stage of trust when you actually recognize it directly and you know that you are this light is the stage of trust, but that's not the whole story. The outward facing light is the stage of person where you're functioning in the world of apparently outward experiences. The outward facing awareness is like responding to all these appearances and realigning all our habits of body, speech, thought, feeling, and so on, realigning them with the awareness itself. Letting the inward-facing awareness permeate, or as one teacher says, colonize all the experiences that we're having. Like the inner awareness is the central land, and it's colonizing all the peripheral islands of experience, so they become part of it. So the outward-facing awareness is like the realm of relationships is a big part of it. And we want to be understood and appreciated by others, like I did at this time at Tassajara. I think because we actually are these others. We are actually one with these others. So when we're not we feel misunderstood or not appreciated by them, I think it's painful because it's out of accord with reality, something like this, because we're actually one being. So when part of our one being doesn't understand the other part, it's naturally painful. It's one way, maybe an unusual way of talking about why that's painful, because we're actually one being. Non-separation. So I think that's part of when Tassajara, when I kind of just broke down like that, I was out of touch with the inward-facing awareness, my own true practice. I was getting overly involved in the superficialities of practice, trying to manipulate the outer conditions of myself, missing the inner light that's actually okay. And then, to top it off, I was out of touch with myself, and then another scorned me for making this great effort at the same time. So that I think that is like the icing on the cake. And I'm not only in touch with the inward-facing awareness, but out of touch with this outward-facing awareness in which we are all connected without separation. So painful. So when we feel this disconnection, how can we remember the inward-facing awareness and the outer-facing awareness? Remembering, finding ways to stop and remember who we are and what's going on here. It's kind of simple, in a way, but it's so easy to forget. And it's subtle what's going on too, so to take the time to just stop and clarify and remember, which is really being on like the cutting edge of the present, always in the present. Often we're just distracted by the past and the future. Richard sent me a great quote the other day. It says, I don't know who said this, but the quote is, if you aren't living on the edge, you're taking up too much space. It's a good one. So can we all live on the edge of our present experience, really looking deeply what is happening here? So Joko Beck here in Everyday Zen. I think she's talking about this outer facing awareness and its relation to the inner facing awareness. In this chapter on relationship is not to each other. He says, true self knows no separation. It may look like I am married to him, but true self, call it the infinite energy potential, or whatever we want to call it, the light that's mysterious and obscure, this true self knows no separation. True self forms into different shapes, but essentially it remains one self, one energy potential. When I say, I am married to you, or I own a Toyota, or I have four children, in everyday language, that is so. But we need to see that it's not the real truth. In fact, I'm not married to somebody or something. I am that person. I am that thing. The true self knows no separation. It's an unusual way of being in the world, I think, when we really see that I am you and things are me. Of course, that doesn't just mean that it blends into some mush. Everything is distinct and functioning, but the interfacing awareness is now expressing itself as the 10,000 things. The inner awareness that is me, the true self, is manifesting as these things. We can't find an actual separation between them, although we just assume there is, right, in our usual life. So Joko Beck goes on, in any situation our devotion should not be to the other person per se, but to the true self. It's kind of unusual too, we think. We don't want to be just devoted to ourself, but we're not talking about our little self, right? In any situation, our devotion should not be to the other person per se, but to our true self. Of course, the other person embodies the true self, yet there is a distinction. If we're involved in a group, our relationship is not to the group, but to the true self of the group. I think this is such an unusual way of talking. I think it's beautiful. By the true self, I'm not talking about some mystical ghost that floats above. True self is nothing at all. And yet it's the only thing that should dominate our life. It is the only master, capital M. Doing zazen or sitting sesshin is for the purpose of better understanding our true self. If we don't understand it, then we will be confused forever by problems and won't know what to do. The only thing to be served is not a teacher, not a center, not a job, not a mate, not a child, but our true self. Does this sound egotistical? I don't think so. So how do we know how to do that? It's not easy, and it takes time and perseverance to learn. She says, practice makes it obvious that in almost all of our life, we are not greatly interested in our true self. We're interested in our small self. We're interested in what we want, what we think, what we hope for, and what would make us feel good. But an intelligent practice illuminates this fact. And it's not good or bad that we are like that, it's just the way it is. So important, I think, to remember. To me, this is like the heart of practice. And easy to get, easy to forget it, personally speaking, even in Zazen. And so Joko goes on, in a concrete situation, what is the way to serve the true self? This is what we really want to know. Come on, give us a concrete situation example. The way may look very rough, very unkind, and sometimes it will be the opposite. There are no formulas. Oh well. Perhaps I give up my good job in New York and stay at home to take care of my parents. Or perhaps I don't. No one but my true self can tell me what I should do. No one can tell me what is best. No one knows except my true self. It doesn't matter what my mother says about it or what my aunt says about it. In a certain sense, it doesn't even matter what I say about it. As one teacher says, your life is none of your business. That's another great quote. Your life is actually none of your business, but it's the business of the true self. She says, but our practice is definitely our business. Our life's not our business, but our practice is our business. And that practice is to learn what it means to serve that which we cannot see, touch, taste, or smell. Essentially, the true self is no thing, and yet it is our master. And when I say it's no thing, I don't mean nothing in the ordinary sense. The master is not a thing, yet it's the only thing. When we're married, we're not married to each other, but to the true self. When we teach a group of children, we're not teaching the children, we're expressing the true self in a way appropriate to the classroom. So it's a little different than just paying attention to what we're doing. Right? This is more like the outer-facing awareness that's informed by the inner-facing awareness. Everything is our true self. She says, now this may sound idealistic and remote, yet every 5 minutes we get a chance to work with it. For example, the interchange with someone who irritates us, the little encounter that goes sour when we feel they should know better, the irritation when my daughter says she'll telephone and she forgets. What is the true self in all these incidents? Usually we can't see the true self, we only see how we miss it. Which is a little bit like Yuen Men saying, everyone has a light, but when we look for this light, we don't see it. It's dark and obscure and mysterious. But what is this light? It's the kitchen pantry, it's the main gate, it's the disappointment when our daughter doesn't call. So, can you follow these two types of awareness? In a sense of the interfacing awareness and the outer? Yes?
Maybe, or maybe not. this is the question I've been pondering lately, and I feel like it kind of applies here. The issue about waiting. Where does waiting fit into all this? You know, if you're the outer facing awareness seems easier for me than the inner facing awareness. That feels like that takes some time and some paying attention to, and then sort of waiting for some illumination, a small bit of illumination to come, and then waiting for more illumination, and, or paying attention to what is going on so that I, you know, become aware or whatever. There's just this whole issue of waiting.
Waiting for the response of the true self.
Waiting for, you know, some illumination to come, or yes, maybe the response of the true self. I mean, there's just, feels like there's a lot of waiting that is involved here. That I think is right. There should be, but I don't know really what Buddhism has to say about waiting.
You mean, waiting, like, are you saying, like, in Zazen?
Yeah, maybe in Zazen.
Waiting for
in Zazen when you're just sitting.
For kind of like a clear vision or a clear understanding.
Or
that
something,
kind of.
Or nothing.
Or do you mean, like, waiting for somebody to, do something like your daughter to call?
No. I'm not.
You mean more like waiting for the illumination?
Slip into no thinking. There's all of this. You cannot force it.
Yes.
You cannot force it. So what is the opposite of forcing it? It feels like waiting to me. I would like to hear what you have to say about that. I know what my head has been saying about that.
Well, one way that comes to mind is we might be able to see it as almost like two extremes, or a little bit like extremes. One is like forcing ourselves into some illumination, and the other would be kind of more passively waiting on the other hand. And those could be like not that extreme. Neither one of them, both of them might be, we're pushing a little bit too much, or we're a little bit too much passively waiting, whereas the middle is free of those kind of deviations or, you know, extremes, could be looking. Waiting is a little bit passive, forcing is a little bit too active, but calmly looking is actually like a practice. Looking back, in this case, looking, investigating, we might say. Investigating. Like, who is it that's having this thought right now? Who is it that's actually not content right now? Who is it that has an aching body in Zazen? Who is it that keeps running through the same distracted thoughts again and again? So that kind of, it's less passive than waiting, right? If I sit here still and long enough, this thoughts will settle like a still lake. That does happen too. But, we might engage the practice of Zazen more than just simply waiting in this more, slightly more active, but from a calm, still silent place, keep looking. What is actually going on here? Who is the source? What is the source of all this? Or if we already know that it is the inward-facing awareness, we can even say, where is the awareness right now? What is this awareness? We know that will be the answer. There's no trick answer. It's not a trick question. Who is this? It's just the source of light. Right? And but its particular practice is quite different from just waiting, or even just Even I think it's even different from just letting go of thought, actually. So it's a little bit more engaged, we might say. But if it's too heavy-handed, then the looking can turn into force, or what was your word? Pushing or forcing something. Very, very gentle looking. Very, very, very gentle, light-hearted, almost playful curiosity. Who is this anyway that just keeps dragging herself to the zendo over and over? Does that address it?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, Patrick.
That quote in Joe Kobeck's book that you said is this self-centered.
Yeah.
It does.
It does sound that way.
Could we put it in the words that you were saying about the light and the true self?
Yeah, I think we have to be really clear that the true self is completely impersonal, right? Like her quote from somebody else where she says, "Your life is none of your business." So if we think the true self is like my true being, forget about those others. That sounds totally worse than selfish. It's like a narcissistic megalomania, right? In any situation, devotion should not be to the other person per se, but to the true self. If we misunderstand that, it's crazy talk, right? So we have to understand this true self is not me, Kokyo or Patrick. It's the light, and it's the that's why I've been exploring this inward facing awareness and outward facing awareness, because it's the exact same awareness, but when it faces inward, it's like the source, and when it faces outward, it is the entire world, it's everything and everybody, total intimacy, total non-separation. Everyone is us. So when we say the true self, it includes actually what we call the other person.
Or you're not devoted to your husband, but you're devoted to Buddha nature.
The light, Buddha nature, yeah. It's a kind of provocative to say the true self, yeah. Or even your true self, because if we think of self in the usual way, we think of self.
Or does Joko use the word source, or is that your
word? That was me.
Okay. Well, you're not devoted to your husband, but to the source. You're not devoted to your children, but to the source.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We could say the relationship, if we include not just the relationship with that person, but the entire, or not even mutual between these two people, but the relationship of everything. It's got to be everything is included. But then we don't get lost in like, oh, what did you say? I'm paying attention to everything. It's like we're actually, you know, it's a specific manifestation of the true self. So we're paying attention to the particularities of this relationship, this one person, and yet we're devoted to the whole works, or we take refuge in Buddha while we're relating to our husband or wife.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I mean, I always like it when people put things in an unusual way that kind of perks up my ears. What? So she says,
"You know, she meant well."
Yeah.
I just want to know what she really meant.
Again, she's in this section. She says, In any situation, our devotion should not be to the other person per se, but to the true self. Of course, the other person embodies the true self. Yet there is a distinction also. Yeah, and what does that mean? Like, if we're involved in a group, our relationship is not to the group, but to the true self of the group. And she clarifies, I'm not talking about some mystical ghost of, like, you know, some actual thing. So that the true self of the group, like right now, here we are in a group. What is it to not think of ourselves as a group of people, but as the one true self of the group? It's amazing, yeah? And to actually try to open to that, and it has these qualities of, it's a little bit frightening to open to it, partly because it's completely out of control. The true self is not in anybody's control. It's everything is interrelatedly co-creating everything. And so that's why it's a little bit scary, because if we don't attend to the true self of the group, but to the group of individuals, then we can say, well, if I kind of manipulate things a little bit like that with that person, and then that person can do this like this, and then it feels safer, right? Because then we have a bunch of individuals. I feel safer as an individual than the true self. Interestingly, safer in a kind of superficial way, right? I think evolution has created the sense of the small self to create a sense of safety, actually, right? If I think of myself as an individual, separate self, then I can protect myself against the group or others or the world. So there's some maybe individual survival benefits for the small self to think this way, but it's very painful too, right? So the true self of the group feels, if we open to that true self, it feels maybe threatening. I can feel that sort of fear of not being in control, actually. But then opening to it more, I think that's like the entry gate, feels like it's a fearful entry gate, which is why I think when we often get close to it, we back away. But if we can just take the chance to occasionally step through the gate, then the other side of the gate, it's not fearful anymore, right? It's beautiful. It's the end of fear. It's true fearlessness, because the separate self is actually the true self that doesn't come and go and can't be destroyed by the other. But as we approach the gate, it seems like the fear of total self annihilation is so threatening. So it's easier maybe then to wait for something to happen. Anything else? Yes.
After your sort of meltdown about the Oreoke meals and the whole thing, did you start eating dinner eating the evening Oreoke meal during breakfast period, or did you continue not to?
I was trying to remember myself whether, you know, eventually I did. And, you know, it was a long time ago. But I have a kind of a kind of memory, my guess would be that maybe I didn't right away, because I would felt like then she, the one who was sitting next to me, kind of like would be the victor, right? So like kind of my stubborn side, I think this is often things go this way, right? At first, if I just give in exactly to what they say right away, I notice this in my relationship with Shoho too, right? She'll give me feedback on something, and at first I'll resist, but like part of me is actually worth considering it actually, right? The first response is like, don't try to control me, right? And then over time, sometimes a minute, sometimes a day, sometimes a month, sometimes a year, eventually, then, okay, no, you actually had a good point, and I'm open to it, and okay. But it's the self that's just doesn't want to let go of itself so quickly. It's nice when we can, sometimes we can. So it might have been like, you know, a few more days of doing it just so she knows that she can't control me, and then I stop eating on my own. I think the ridiculousness of the separate self is like this, right? I get the credit for it. Yeah, we want to be seen and appreciated. Has anyone ever met Madame Butterfly, who lives in Santa Cruz? She lives kind of on the streets.
Yes.
Oh, you know her. You might know her not by name, but by her like glittery face and like colored feathers and streamers and all kinds of like stuff draped off her. It's kind of beautiful, and maybe she is a fairy wand even. She walks around like this, and I ran into her the other day in the evening. She hangs around outside CVS sometimes, and I had talked with her before, but not for like a year or something. I hadn't seen her, and she said, "Hi, I'm Madame Butterfly, and what's your name?" And I said, "Kokyo." "Oh, I remember you." And she just like just lit up, and I think it's this thing of being appreciated and understood. She was carrying a book in her hand of Hildegard of Bingen. Heavy duty reading for, you know, on the street outside CVS. She says, "Yeah, it's all in here." She opened it. And she's just so happy to, I don't know how many people, I think maybe in Santa Cruz, maybe a lot of people might appreciate Madame Butterfly. But maybe she hadn't had such appreciation and understanding for a while. And I think she was just happy. Even just a little understanding like that. Just like, "That's a cool book, and I like your glitter." I just wanted to finish one last quote from my teacher, Tenzin Roshi, that I just came across that struck me, related to this inward and outer facing awareness. He said, "If we go through a whole day without remembering what is most important to us, that's a risky day." Who knows what we might do? What havoc we might wreak without remembering what's most important. We dedicate the merit of our gathering as one true self to the one true self expressing itself as suffering beings. May they remember the light and find ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.